We do not escape our boundaries or our innermost being. We do not change. It is true that we may be transformed, but we always walk within our boundaries, within the marked off circle. Ernst Jung. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd. As always, I'm your host. I'd like to thank everyone for joining me this week. I appreciate the support. If you're a newcomer, welcome in. Returning listener, thank you all. As always, I really appreciate the support. So first things first, I do want to go ahead and issue kind of a big correction to last week's episode. And as you'll see, that's kind of going to change the order that we're going to be covering things. I mistyped some information in my notes and copied some of my notes section, and I put it in the wrong section, and it messed me up. So I didn't even realize what I had said until as I was listening back and adding pictures to the YouTube video. And as I heard this, what I just said, I was like, wait, that's missing some very important context and additional information. Oh no, I screwed that up. So when I was talking about living on the western islands of Southeast Asia, like Sumatra and Java, I mentioned that the people living there were more closely related to the Samoan peoples, most likely. But that is not the case, or at least that doesn't appear to be the case. I wrote my notes for both the Samoan peoples and the island populations, but while it's true for the Samoan that there is a little bit of overlap between the Samoan and the Halbanian and the Sinoy, there has been no genetic information to link the current peoples of those areas, or at least the majority of the people from those areas, with the Samoan. Now, at least that's what we've determined from the genetic sources and testing that we've been able to do so far. Now, some modern populations do have small amounts of Halbanian and Sinoy ancestry, but that comes from later waves of migrations. But the most likely ancestry of humans living in these areas at the time of 6 to 4000 BC are related to the first Homo sapiens to enter the area via land bridge, or not the first, but the wave that did not stop, the wave that did stop, while, of course, you know, ahead of them were early Australian Aboriginal peoples and the peoples we'll be talking about this week. So these are the people that did not continue to Sahul, which, if you remember from our earlier seasons and episodes, is kind of the name for the combined continent of Australia and the islands of what is now Melanesia, or at least what some people refer to as Melanesia. Remember, with the lower water level, when humans were first migrating to the area, there was a land bridge connecting those bodies. Now, as we'll talk about, of course, by this season, that land bridge has completely receded, but we'll get into that. So, making these mistakes, I'm taking this as a sign to push back our coverage of Northeast Asia, and instead cover the islands of Melanesia and Australia between the years of 6 and 4000 BC, BCE, whichever you prefer. Though I don't know that, of course, we will finish that topic this week. There's going to be a lot I want to get into Australia. So that will probably be its own thing, and then, you know, maybe a couple of episodes, maybe even three. We'll just have to wait and see. But, you know, best laid plans of mice and men and all that. So, to start with, we talked last season about how there is some level of early agriculture. You know, that early horticulture leading into agriculture that was being practiced in parts of what is now Papua New Guinea, starting around 7000 BC. And these would be things like bananas, taro, breadfruit trees, what have you. And this trend is continuing and expanding. It's possible that sugarcane is also being domesticated this season. The dates I see on this estimate some of the dates I've seen have it happening as early as around 6,000, and others putting this process starting right at 4,000 BC. Though, from what I understand, and I could be misreading the kind of the science of this, because genetics is not my strong suit, there's not too much to differentiate wild sugarcane from domesticated strains. Obviously, wild strains tend to be larger, but this is something that, isn't universally true. And, in some places, even domesticated strains don't necessarily get that large. So, just make of this what we will. It's hard to tell for sure. Some of the newer literature I've read pushes it to an earlier date. I haven't included sugar domestication in the domestication episodes because the dates vary so wildly. But it does look like that the earlier date is becoming more widely accepted. So I'll include sugarcane when we get to the domestication episodes for next season. Now, there is also evidence of parts of Papua New Guinea and some of the neighboring islands seeing humans introduce, or in some cases, reintroduce trees to areas that were deforested, either by themselves or through natural disasters like fires, things like that. And these trees were not just used for food, at least not primarily, but for making sure that wood was always plentiful. So they're practicing some level of forestry, or Seville culture is one of the terms I think you can use for that. Now, despite these agricultural and horticultural advancements, there is still plenty of hunting and gathering and fishing taking place. In fact, due to the rising sea levels reaching close to modern heights, fishing and sea animals are becoming much more important. And not just when it comes to food production, at least, to peoples living along the coast. You begin to see rock paintings dated to around this period and a little bit after begin to depict more oceanic marine life as well as crocodiles. And this is also something you see even in Australia. It's not just happening in Papua New Guinea. This is a trend that's happening throughout the larger Melanesian, Australian areas. Now, their tools are also beginning to become more refined as well. While they don't adapt quite as many types of smaller Neolithic bladelets, they do take to polishing their stone tools to a much higher level than they had prior. Basically, they polish them longer, they make them smoother, and that kind of gives them a nice shape and a nice design, and it kind of helps to, hold them and secure them. And they're doing this even for some of their larger tools, things like mortar and pestles. They're kind of shaping and polishing these to a degree that is pretty comparable to a lot of other Neolithic cultures, even if they're not using smaller Neolithic type blades quite as much. They're also making new types of decoration and possible religious artifacts, or maybe artifacts promoting fertility. They've found things like there was one article I saw that had it was a piece of obsidian carved into the outline of a phallus, or at least that is the theory. I don't think it looks too much like one, but it is, maybe at certain angles it is kind of a rough shape of a phallus. But as the archaeologist who found it said, it's too thin to be anything useful. But it was very, finely handcrafted into the shape it was in. So maybe it is. It's hard to say. Now, when it comes to languages the peoples in these regions are speaking, It's very, very hard to get an idea of what we're dealing with. Today, linguists classify all 800 or so Papuan languages together. Though this is only a geographic distinction, no linguists think all 800 or so of these languages are related to each other. There are multiple studies kind of trying to systematize these and, you know, break them down into languages that maybe are consistent, that maybe are related to each other directly. But the numbers in these, once again, vary wildly. I've seen some with as little families as 9, or at least they've been able to create 9, you know, mostly consistent families. And then there are some that they've gotten, I think, up into the 60s. It's a wide range. And that's not even counting. There are quite a few isolates, languages that are spoken just by a single group of people living in the area or on one of the islands that is not related to any other language. They maybe have one or two loan words, but, you know, that would be it. So it's very hard to break into, especially as a layman. I've studied a little bit of linguistic stuff, you know, prior to starting the show and doing the show, but it's very hard to really dive into because there is so much, not necessarily disagreement, because some of these theories don't necessarily disagree with each other. They've just focused on other languages more than others. So I would say these, I'm trying to think of the best word for this, variants in organization and classification. Just to try to help move the show along and, you know, for future episodes, I kind of had to pick just kind of one current organizational chart kind of to like help me visualize and keep track of this. So I've decided to go with the Glottolog, which is like an online linguistic site, and they keep track of a lot of stuff. And they did like a really big update around, I think it was like 2018, 2019, somewhere in there. And there have been more recent ones. I think one came out in like last year. And some of that guy's work has actually showed up in the Glottolog thing. So, again, these theories don't necessarily all contradict each other. But this is an area with, you know, due to the environment and the political situation in the area and just the massive number of languages, it's really hard to get a lot of study done and characterization. But Glottolog recognizes 70 independent families and 55 language isolates. And again, it's important to keep in mind that these are not all of the languages spoken in Melanesia. These are just the ones that are not part of the Austronesian language family. So those will show up in, you know, in future, but for right now, you know, ancestors of the languages that I'm about to talk about are probably being spoken, you know, all over parts of what is now Papua New Guinea, as well as the neighboring islands around that. I've decided to talk about some of the isolates right now because, well, I don't know when I'll be able to get much, much more time to talk about this. But this kind of shows, like, you know, this is probably the condensed version of like languages on the island. There's probably, you know, fewer languages spoken now than there was in the past. So, just, you know, keep that in mind. And some of these languages are spoken by a very small number of people. There is one isolated language known as Abenomam. There are about 300 speakers, and they are native to the Maber-Amo-Hulu district in what is now the Papua, which is in western New Guinea. the speakers of this language, they just occupy a small handful of villages. I think it's like three or four. They are surrounded entirely by a group of languages known as the Lakes Plain languages. And all of these languages are tonal, and Abenomen is not. And tonal, for those that aren't aware, tone is like, you know, you use the pitch of how you're speaking to distinguish, like, grammatical or, you know, lexical meanings. Another language isolate that is also in Western Papuan is the Abun language. Now, I say this is an isolate. It's spoken by about 3,000 people. There are some people who think it's West Papuan, but that was, you know, again, that's just one group's interpretation. Others do list it as an isolate, and again, Glottolog does list it as an isolate. Though they do have some borrowed words from other languages. They have adopted some of the maritime languages from Biak, which is a Austronesian language. So they will, you can guess, okay, so these people kind of live not too far from the coast on what is the Bird's Head of Papua New Guinea. If you look at a map, it's that little kind of beak poking out of the western edge of Papua New Guinea. They're kind of on the northern central part of that little formation. So these people gained a lot of their words for, you know, boats and things like that from interactions, most likely, with Austronesians speaking the Biak languages, or at least the ancestors of modern Biak languages. They do have a few more speakers than Abenomen. They have around 3,000 or so, at least from the most recent reports of that. But even that report is around, at this point, almost 30 years old, I believe. But they're spread along around 20 villages as opposed to three or four. Another language, and let's find one on the eastern, kind of eastern side of Papua. So you do have the Wiru or Witu language. This is spoken by around 15,000, give or take a couple hundred individuals. This is one of those ones that there's a little bit of a disagreement about. Some people classify this with Tiberan, or they put it in the Tiberan-Pawayan language family, though that is not universally accepted. They do have some overlap in some, you know, in some vocabulary, as well as, I guess, kind of their syntax structure, but this isn't one that they necessarily can be completely tied together, at least no one's been able to yet. They did have a translation of a Bible into the Wiru language. This was done by Harlan Kerr. He was a missionary. He lived with the Wiru for many, many, many years, and he produced a Wiru Bible translation, and he also did several dictionary, kind of like pseudo little dictionaries to kind of help with the translation. And he did his master's thesis on their language as well, or at least parts of their language. Their population apparently has been fairly stable. They were reported to have around 15,000 speakers in the 60s, then again in the 80s. And since then, I haven't seen any updates on their population, but they seem to be, you know, at least stable in terms of speakers. And they're in the kind of the Southern Highlands, which is on the eastern. It's the Southern Highlands province, but it's on the eastern half of the island of Papua New Guinea. Another very small language isolate is Kapori, that has around 200 speakers as of 2006. And it's just spoken on a couple of villages along the north bank of the Edinburgh River. Excuse me. Aside from the very small number of speakers, they do have
some, you know, loan words from some other languages. They adopted the word taro to just mean eat. So the plant or the, you know, the crop taro, which is very important on the island and as well as many other kind of tropical jungle areas, became their word for eat. Their word for one is kakua. The word for hair is su, and the word for leg is tai. Dog is unu, bird is irini, and blood is kumu. This is kind of in contrast to purari, also known as the mao, though that is a considered somewhat of a pejorative these days, so they prefer the term purari. It's spoken by about 7,000 individuals as of 2011. They've even had some scripture translated, much like Wiru, compared to, say, some of the vocab for Kapori, excuse me. So their word for eat is Navai. Their word for hair is Kimari. Blood is Aro. Leg is Ari. Then you have one is Manao. Or Mano. I'm not quite sure how to pronounce that. So, you know, these are just examples of a few of the language isolates on the island. And again, some of them may or may not be isolates. Some of them may be related to some other languages. But it just goes to show that, you know, despite how relatively small Papua New Guinea is, or the island of New Guinea, technically speaking, Papua New Guinea is the country. I'm sure I've been driving some people crazy with that. But regardless, these are just handfuls of examples of quite a few, you know, languages that have, you know, have their roots on the island without any necessarily too much of an impact from outside languages. And so I think this is something that, you know, shows how, you know, despite how relatively small the island may be, you know, in terms of, you know, landmass, it's still, you know, large enough to support quite a diverse amount of languages and peoples, even, you know, on the islands itself or themselves. And, you know, the vocabulary is different despite, you know, there being a lot of overlap in terms of food. But you got to remember there's also differences in environment. You have peoples that are living, you know, along the same rivers that they've lived, you know, for thousands of years. You've got people up in the highlands. You've got people along the coasts. So it's not just their food. It's not just the weather or the temperature. They are also dealing with, you know, very unique ecosystems in the islands themselves that, despite, you know, all being on the same island, they're all, you know, fairly different. And it also shows that, you know, there is a big kind of overlap between, or I guess lack of an overlap between a lot of intermarriages between some of these groups. They all tend to be fairly insular, at least compared to some other places where you see a lot more of borrowing between languages. But again, that's not universal, but it is something, you know, that if the number of isolates holds true, is something that you don't see too many other places. I mean, look at somewhere in Europe, for instance. There's very few language isolates. There's only a couple. Or say, you know, places in East Asia, for example, there are, you know, a couple of isolates, but by and large, nothing to the level that you're seeing on the Melanesian islands. Now, part of that is that travel's probably easier. You know, you have more people able to travel than you maybe see in you know, Papua New Guinea. That's not to say there's not trade. That's not to say there aren't people interacting with each other. There certainly are, but this is probably limited to a much smaller group. And due to the geography of the island, there are only so many ways you can get around. And there's very little, if any, people who are making like a full journey. And that's going to be true until the Austronesians arrive. And even then, once the Austronesians get there, polities on these islands are a little bit slower to develop than they are in other places. That's not to say there's no society. There's not to say there's no civilization. It's just there's no, or at least there's a slower development of any kind of like centralized states or semi-centralized states or what have you. Most of the trade comes from people, you know, closer to the sea. And there's very little expeditions from these people arriving from the ocean going up into the highlands. That's not something that you, at least that I'm aware of, it has happened very much at all until, you know, the Europeans show up. Now, that's not to say that these, you know, the people living in the highlands didn't have any kind of knowledge of people of the outside, or that people living in the lowlands or along the coast didn't have any knowledge of people living in the highlands. It's just that there's, you know, less of an impact going both ways between those peoples for a number of reasons that we'll get into later. So, I think I'm going to go ahead and call this episode here. I could just keep listing off languages, but there's a lot of them, and they all, you know, they're all important, and I'll try to cover some more of these isolates, but there's very little information on some of these people. Sometimes the language is recorded, but, you know, the language you speak doesn't necessarily, you know, have a larger identity, at least in those cases of, you know, a couple of hundred speakers. And there's not necessarily like a unified tribal identity based on their languages. Some of these groups neighboring each other, you know, they may not see themselves as being quite the same as a neighbor who speaks the same language. They might have, again, closer ties with people, at least economically speaking, that speak a completely different language. And, you know, there's actually, I think, a fairly high amount of, you know, people speaking multiple languages, or at least a little bit of, you know, a little bit of several languages, you know, enough to get along. So, but that's something I'm going to have to study a lot more to really speak definitively on. That's just probably a little, I mean, it definitely is a guess on my part. So, but yeah, so I think I'm going to go ahead and call it for this week. We will not be back next week. Remember, I'm taking, next Monday off for the long 4th of July weekend. I very much need a break. I've taken a couple extra days off from work as well. So I am very much looking forward to that. But we will return that following Monday. And we'll be talking about Australia. It'll probably be a two-parter. Maybe a three. We'll see. It'll just depend on how much work I get done during the break. So, but I appreciate everyone who came by. Please like, subscribe, rate 5 stars, download, whatever your service of choice asks you to do to support a creator, please do so. If you'd like to provide any comments, questions, constructive criticism, please let me know. You can do so at war@revpod@gmail.com. You can contact me via direct message on X/Twitter. You can also call a comment on any of my YouTube videos. I do read those. It may take a day or two for me to see them, but I do try and respond regularly. And I also stream on YouTube and Twitch. As I said, I've been monetized on Twitch. Subscribe on YouTube. I'm not monetized there yet, hopefully. One day, maybe. But, you know, please like, subscribe there if you watch us there. If you watch on YouTube, there's usually, at least the last couple of episodes, there's usually some type of visual component, though I don't know that there will be one this week. It's kind of late. This, so I don't know that I'll have time to add some pictures, and there weren't really too many pictures to add. I tried to find a picture, like a clear one, of the obsidian phallus, but unfortunately The only picture I could find of it was in black and white, and it was from a weird angle. So I don't know that it would be good to show on the video. So, but regardless, so if you'd like to reach out, please do. I hope you all have a good rest of your day and week from listening to this. And if you're in the U.S., I hope you have a safe and happy 4th of July. And I will see everyone next time. Peace.